This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.
The headlines this hour. Iraqi officials and MPs pay tribute to top Iranian General Qasem Soleimani and senior Iraqi commander Abu Mahdi al-Mohandas, who were assassinated by the U.S. nearly a year ago. NATO and Afghan officials say the Bagram airfield, which is the largest U.S. military base in Afghanistan, has come under rocket attack. Also in the headlines, the U.S. government says it plans to shut down its two remaining consulates in Russia amid growing tensions between the two countries. Thanks for joining us. Iraqi officials and parliamentarians have held a ceremony to pay tribute to top Iranian General Qasem Soleimani and senior Iraqi commander Abu Mahdi al-Mohandas, who were assassinated by the U.S. in January. Chairman of the Popular Mobilization Forces, Fali al-Fayyad, hailed Soleimani and Abu Mohandas for their anti-terror efforts. He underlined that the two commanders sacrificed their lives to protect the Iraqi nation against enemies. He called General Soleimani and his companion heroes of the Iraqi nation. He stressed that the Popular Mobilization Forces will remain loyal to them and their ideals. General Soleimani and Abu Mahdi al-Mohandas were killed in a U.S. drone strike in Iraq. The killing sparked anti-American sentiments and prompted lawmakers to approve a bill demanding complete withdrawal of U.S. forces from the country. Several rockets have hit a major U.S. airbase in Afghanistan's central province of Parwan. NATO and Afghan officials say that at least five projectiles targeted the Bagram airfield. Parwan authorities say the rockets were fired from the province's central area of Kalandakhil. They say that several other rockets were foiled by the police. There are no reports of any damage or casualties yet. American officials have not commented about the incident. There's also no claim of responsibility, but the base has been targeted by the Taliban militant group in the past. An Afghan Taliban delegation led by its political chief visits Pakistan to discuss peace efforts. The visit comes as there is a 20-day break in the intra-Afghan dialogue, which has so far made little headway on the future of Afghanistan. Kamran Yusuf has more.
The Afghan Taliban delegation is in Pakistan to discuss the peace efforts. The delegation is headed by Mullah Brother, the head of Taliban's political office in Doha. The visit comes after Taliban and Afghan government took a 20-day break in their talks taking place in Doha. After months of negotiations, the two sides recently agreed on the rules of engagement. But there is no progress on the comprehensive ceasefire as Taliban have linked the truce with peace deal. But the Pakistan's foreign minister, who also met the Taliban leaders, said Taliban have shown their readiness to seek an end to the war.
Taliban are convinced that the continuation of war is neither in their interest nor in the interest of Afghanistan. I get the feeling after my negotiations with the Taliban that they are serious to end this conflict, which is very encouraging.
Afghan Taliban and the U.S. signed a landmark deal in February this year. The deal outlines a roadmap for the U.S. troops withdrawal from Afghanistan. In return, Taliban agreed not to allow Afghan soil to be used again by terrorist groups. Given Pakistan's historic ties with the Taliban, the U.S. and Afghan government expect Islamabad to ensure that the Taliban live up to their commitment.
Pakistan is in a position to use its lever, but it will not, I think. It will just facilitate. It will try, as Foreign Minister Qureshi has said in this event, that Pakistan will try to let the Afghan. There will be no imposition of any process on Afghan.
At the moment, all eyes are on the incoming U.S. president as to whether he will follow the same policy on Afghanistan or take a different course. On paper, there seems no change in the policy of U.S. President-elect Joe Biden with regard to Afghanistan, but he may not hasten the troops withdrawal as sought by President Trump. This means the situation in Afghanistan will remain uncertain, at least in the foreseeable future. Kamran Yusuf, Islamabad.
The administration of U.S. President Donald Trump is planning to shut down two remaining consulates in Russia. A copy of notification obtained by the U.S. media shows that the State Department had informed Congress of the decision last week. The closure of the missions in Vladivostok and Yekaterinburg would leave the U.S. with only its embassy in Moscow. The notice had cited caps placed by Russian authorities in 2017 on the number of American diplomats in the country as the reason. However, the move comes at a time of heightened tensions between the two nations amid the recent revelation of a massive cyber attack against numerous U.S. government departments and agencies. On Friday, Secretary of State Mike Pompeo said that Russia was, quote, pretty clearly behind the cyber attacks. Moscow, however, has denied any involvement. Russian President Vladimir Putin has criticized the U.S. for starting a new arms race, saying that Moscow's development of hypersonic weapons was a forced response to Washington. Marina Kortanova reports from Moscow.
Russian President Vladimir Putin held his annual press conference. This year it was held in a new format, video conferencing, because of pandemic.
The end-of-year Q&A session is a rare chance to get President Putin to answer important issues and draw attention to the country's problems. It has long become one of the biggest media events in the country, broadcasted live on main news channels and radio stations in Russia for the whole duration.
Speaking about the new START arms control treaty between Washington and Moscow, Putin accused the U.S. of starting a new arms race. Putin reiterated his call urging Washington to extend the new START arms control treaty for 1 year.
Now there's a threat that strategic arms reduction treaty is terminated. This would mean that there are no more restrictions on the arms race. None at all. We have called and continue to call on our Western partners to extend this treaty for at least a year. During this year, we would have substantive talks, as diplomats say, on what to do next and how to live on.
Putin said he believed U.S. President-elect Joe Biden is open to dialogue on the issue, but added Russia needs some reaction from the U.S.
That it is the last point that connects Russian Federation with the United States on strategic issues, because all other treaties and agreements signed by Soviet Union, Russian Federation and the United States were dismissed, were destroyed by administration of Trump. Now we are entering a new period of development in American policy. That's why we hope that previous all agreements and treaties will be respected.
The new Strategic Arms Reduction Treaty, also known as START, is the last remaining agreement that maintains a nuclear balance between the two countries. Putin also said that the unfounded poisoning scenario of opposition politician Alexei Navalny was in fact part of the U.S.-backed plot repeated by media to try to discredit the Russian leader. He stressed that Navalny was not important enough to be a target. Navalny, 44, was taken ill on a domestic flight on August 20. He was later transported to the German capital. German doctors, however, claimed Navalny had been poisoned with a substance from the group of cholinesterase inhibitors. Since then, Germany and other Western governments have been attacking Russia with accusations that it poisoned Navalny. Moscow has repeatedly and strongly rejected the allegation. Marina Kutunova, Moscow.
U.S. President Donald Trump has repeated his claim of a voter fraud in the last month's presidential election, even after the Electoral College ratified his rival Joe Biden's victory this week. In a tweet, Trump hailed one of his aides for releasing a report that says the November 3rd vote was fraudulent. White House trade advisor Peter Navarro claimed that irregularities were, quote, more than sufficient to swing the outcome in Trump's favor. Citing the report, Trump said it is statistically impossible to have lost the election. He encouraged his supporters to stage what he called a big protest in Washington, D.C. on January the 6th. Trump said the protests will be wild. Meanwhile, U.S. President Donald Trump has signed into law a two-day stopgap extension of existing federal funds to avoid a government shutdown amid the coronavirus pandemic. The president inked the legislation to keep the government running about an hour and a half before midnight deadline to pass spending legislation. The $900 billion bill would be part of a massive $1.4 trillion government spending package. The debate follows months of partisan finger-pointing and inaction with regards to the coronavirus crisis. Significant differences remain between Republicans and Democrats, including a dispute over a Republican-backed plan to rein in Federal Reserve lending programs. Democrats say that the measure would hamstring President-elect Joe Biden's ability to respond to the ongoing economic crisis after he takes office on January 20th. The coronavirus pandemic has enormously increased demand for food assistance in the U.S., even some of the country's affluent regions. An aerial video has showed hundreds of cars lining up at a food bank in Los Angeles, California, to pick up free groceries. People in many other states, like Alaska and Georgia, are also turning to food distribution centers. Activists say that food banks are under extra pressure ahead of the upcoming holidays, as requests have skyrocketed. They say that millions of Americans are barely making ends meet and need help to feed their families. Moreover, data by the U.S. Census Bureau indicate that more Americans are going hungry than at any point during the COVID-19 pandemic. Food insecurity has doubled since last year, reaching the highest level since 1998. Senior geopolitical analyst Alexander Azotgan says that police unions in the U.S. have fueled police brutality by helping their members get away with their actions.
Black people are fed up just being downright murdered in front of cameras, and nothing really substantive being done to the police officers is a moral outrage. Of course, the majority of officers, we are told, are good people, kind people, law-abiding themselves, but the bad apples seem to really be getting away, you know, literally with murder. And part of that is because of the way the police unions are set up. They want to make sure these people are just not fired so they can get away with what they're getting away with. But from a greater picture, we are in the midst of a revolution. This is this is apparent to everyone who has the eyes to see and the wisdom to understand. The Black Lives Movement, has touched upon some very sensitive things that somehow were ignored more or less during the presidency of President Obama. I believe he was too reconciliatory. He wanted to play both sides of the fence, and now they're coming out in full force.
The U.S. is well known for its reluctance to institute a strong social safety net, but the coronavirus has upended its quality and cost of child care. Ramin Mazohari has more from Chicago.
The situation for child care in the United States was already perhaps the worst in the Western world. Only Ireland spends less on its children. The average annual price is higher for child care than for university tuition, and the cost is second only to a family's rent or mortgage. That was before Corona hit. This year, childcare costs have soared nationwide a back-breaking 60%, according to the Center for American Progress, but it has doubled or almost tripled in big cities. Plenty of households weren't prepared for any childcare costs at all, but many free public schools have been shuttered for months due to Corona. The huge price increase has caused parents to quit their jobs just to watch their children, and produced financial anxiety for even moderately comfortable households.
Staying home shouldn't be an oath of poverty. You know, if you can afford private child care, great. Let's have public child care that's decent and affordable and facilitates people and protects families, because, you know, child care should be a right.
The federal government's only household relief package this year gave qualified parents just $500 per child. That covers just a few weeks of childcare. It's not just financial. The upending of supervision programs for minors is being called a huge setback in early development and child safety. In cities like Chicago, a minor is 25 times more likely to die from murder than from coronavirus, but closed schools can't provide any structure, and so 2020 has seen a huge increase in juvenile violence and crime.
It's been very stressful on children, and there's been a lot of fallout. I think there's a lot of fallout with a lot of drug therapies being used at younger and younger ages for children. I wonder how that would be if we had better child care and more child care. There's more young people, depression, suicide. And I wonder again how much of this is a result of lack of affordable childcare.
Despite the increased cost for parents, the scientific data, and the negative effect on child learning, many in the U.S. want schools to remain closed until autumn 2021. The average parents can only wonder how they'll be able to foot that bill. Ramin Mazahiri, Chicago.
A group of British MPs has warned that Britain has not yet provided all of the complex IT systems and port infrastructure needed to ensure Brexit runs smoothly. The group said that they were concerned about the overall state of readiness. They warned that some decisions on infrastructure have been taken too late. London and Brussels should clinch an agreement by the end of this month. That is when a transition period following the UK's January withdrawal expires. The two sides want each other to compromise on key sticking points regarding their future trade. Both have raised the possibility of a no deal.
Before entering his latest and perhaps last round of negotiations with UK counterparts, the EU's chief Brexit negotiator, Michel Barnier, addressed the European Parliament early on Friday morning.
Nous sommes à un moment de vérité.
It is the moment of truth.
Il nous reste,
we have very little time remaining, just a few hours to work through these negotiations in a useful fashion if we want this agreement to enter into force on the 1st of January.
There are less than 2 weeks to go before Britain might crash out of the Brexit transition period without a crucial EU trade deal.
Shameful UK government strategy.
Some EU lawmakers are in no doubt as to which side is to blame for the deadlock.
The UK government is taking endless time to realise that some illusions of Brexit simply cannot be delivered.
Many legislators claim the UK faces financial ruin if Boris Johnson's government fails to reach an agreement with the EU.
Meanwhile, the Scottish National Party is waiting in the wings to call a second independence referendum that could very well see the breakup of the United Kingdom.
It has been pointed out that long delays can already be witnessed at EU-UK border crossings.
Dear British friends, is this what you voted for? Passport stamps? And lorry queues? This moment is a victory for Europe.
But the European Union is in no position to gloat, it has been argued.
The real division isn't between the EU and the UK. It's between the haves and the have-nots. And we start dealing with that, or there'll be a lot more Brexits to come.
Deal or no deal, business groups say the EU needs to pursue major structural reforms, especially in the context of Brexit.
There's a mismatch clearly, so we need better mobility. We need to be able to match the supply with the demand for workers across Europe, not just within member states.
Fishing rights remain the major sticking point in the negotiations. One EU lawmaker has reminded Boris Johnson that his closest ally will soon be history. The COVID-19 pandemic is still here, and so he should choose his next moves carefully. Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
And that is it for World News. It's bye-bye for now.
This is the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran broadcasting. The voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily, round the clock, for listeners across the globe. The voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran can be heard via the internet, shortwave, medium wave, FM, and satellites. Our listeners in the Indian subcontinent can listen to the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran via shortwave 41 meters, 7,300 kilohertz every day from 1520 to 1620 UTC. Also, our listeners in Europe can tune in to the English service of the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran via shortwave 49 meters, 6,040 kilohertz, and in Southern Africa via shortwave 25 meters, 11,880 kilohertz every day from 1920 to 2020. Our listeners in Tehran can also listen to our programs via FM 91.5 MHz. You can also listen to the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird, Eutelsat 3B, and Iran Sat or Bat 5 and via the internet. Our internet address is parstoday.com/en. And now you can listen to IRIB English Radio by your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for the details. Please send your correspondence to the English program, P.O. Box number 19395-6767, Tehran, Islamic Republic of Iran, or email us to englishradio@irib.ir. We would be very pleased to have your comments about audio quality and other means. Thank you.
بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم
السلام عليكم ورحمة الله
Selection of Ayatollah Khamenei's viewpoints
همه با وجود قده سرطانی اسرائیل مخالفیم
All of us are opposed to the cancerous tumor Israel
وجه مشترک همه وحدت امت اسلامی
Unity of Islamic Ummah is the aspect that all of Islamic denominations have in common.
This is a part of a speech delivered on October 12, 2020 by Ayatollah Khamenei, the leader of the Islamic Revolution, via video conference with the participants at the joint graduation ceremony held at the Imam Ali Military Academy.
In the name of Allah, the Beneficent, the Merciful. All praise is due to Allah, the Lord of the worlds, and peace and greetings be upon our Master and Prophet, and upon his pure household, especially the one remaining with Allah on earth. Greetings be upon Hussein, upon Ali ibn al-Hussein, upon the children of Hussein, and upon the companions of Hussein. First of all, I wish to congratulate you, dear brave, experienced, and young graduates in our Armed Forces Academies, and also the arrival of young cadets in military academies to prepare themselves for passing through these glorious stages. Moreover, I would like to thank the Chief of the General Staff of the Armed Forces and the commanders in the Armed Force Academies for their brief and beneficial statements and reports. I also thank the Master of Ceremony for his eloquent speech. The organization of this ceremony at the same time and in the same place, during which all armed forces academies gather together, contains a good piece of news: the emergence of an opportunity of the armed forces academies to get close to one another, to benefit from each other's experiences, and to cooperate with and to help one another.
Your light and love, all I see. Nothing more I'd ever want or need. My Lord, protect me from dishonor. Grant me faith to be stronger.
Their relationship is certainly to their benefit, and this ceremony has been organized in the illustrious Imam Ali alayhi salam Military Academy. I cannot forget that in the year 1359 in the Iranian calendar, in the beginning of the imposed war, a number of students from this academy went to the front, to Ahwaz and Susangerd, and engaged in fighting. They were still students, but they began their endeavor while they were still students. My dear ones, one of the things that gives value to an endeavor is the goal behind it. If we want to evaluate things, we should see what goals exist behind them. If this idea is correct, which is certainly correct, then studying in military academies and in armed forces organizations is one of the loftiest and most valuable endeavors. Why? It is so because by studying these universities, our youth enter the armed forces with the purpose of ensuring the security of the country, and security is a noble and fundamental value for the country.
Alhamdulillah, alhamdulillah, all praises to Allah.
Africa Today.
Nigeria, a country facing widespread violence. This week, on the fifth anniversary of the Zaria massacre, many Muslims are still struggling for their rights. The massacre took place in Zaria, Kaduna State, in 2015. After a brutal attack by the Nigerian army, at least 348 civilians were killed. That's according to official tally. And 347 bodies were secretly buried. Welcome to Africa Today. I'm your host, Mubarak Kenya. In this episode, we look at the massacre, asking whether those responsible have been held accountable after 5 years. Apart from that, we delve into Nigeria's quest to end police brutality as the country continues suffering from terror attacks by Takfiri terrorists. Stay tuned.
Zaria massacre. Those killed in Zaria during the notable human rights violation in mid-December 2015 were mostly members of the Islamic movement in Nigeria. Top Shia cleric Sheikh Ibrahim Zakzaki was arrested along with his wife Mualima Zina, and many are blaming Saudi Arabia for funding the massacre. The victims were unarmed protesters, and human rights organizations have asserted that the violent crackdown, which continued for 3 days, was carried out without any provocation.
A commission of inquiry inside Nigeria also called for prosecution of all those involved in the killings. Yet, years later, justice is yet to be served. Our first guest is Mr. Masoud Shajare, human rights campaigner at the Islamic Human Rights Commission. Mr. Shajare, welcome to our program. On the fifth anniversary of the massacre, how much do we know about what actually happened on that day?
Well, part of the truth have come out already. Even in their own investigation, which was set up almost a year after the massacre, it was a number of things came up. One was the fact that, according to them, over 400 people were massacred, but we've got the actual figure, it is just under 1,000. And they also admitted that they have dig mass graves, and many people have been buried in those mass graves.
Thank you, Mr. Shajare, for that. Now, in the studio, we are also joined by Mr. Hussein Abdullahi, a member of the Islamic movement in Nigeria, who will elaborate to us on the situation. Hello, Mr. Abdullahi, and welcome to our program. Now, for a start, can you tell us exactly what is the situation of Sheikh Ibrahim Zakzaki and his wife, who've been incarcerated now for almost, actually, 5 years?
Yes, the situation is still worse. That is, they were in worse health condition because there is no appropriate medical attention given to them. And for the Sheikh Ibrahim Zakzaki, recent analysis or recent investigation revealed that he has about 55 foreign body shrapnels, bullet shrapnels in his body.
Not removed yet, yeah.
Yes, none has been removed. Mm-hmm. Therefore, he complained of some pain from his head downwards, mm-hmm. and it was said that they must be removed before he can have his mm-hmm. health been improved.
Now, thank you, Mr. Abdullahi, for that elaboration, and stay tuned for more.
The details of the massacre of hundreds of men, women, and children by soldiers in Zaria are gruesome. Some were injured and burned alive, and the bodies of those killed were left littered in the streets. The arrest and prosecution of the military officers involved in the crackdown is part of the movement's quest for justice, which is yet to materialize.
Let us not forget, 5 working days a week, Nigerian Islamic movement and its supporters come in the street in Abuja and other cities, every single working days, and they've been shot at, they have been gassed, they have been killed, they have been arrested, they have been tortured, but it hasn't stopped.
The Islamic movement of Nigeria has been a target of the Nigerian government's heavy-handed crackdown from the get-go. The members' peaceful protests are suppressed by military forces as the Nigerian government has banned them as terrorists and detained their leader.
I just hope that we will continue to protest until they let us have contact with them, not show us pictures or give statements in press conferences. They should let us see them. If they don't let us see them, then we don't know that if they're healthy or not. We just know what they tell us. So hopefully the protests are peaceful and that we're not attacking anybody. We're just peacefully protesting that we want to see them and we want to make sure that they're alive. And they're alive and they're getting treatment. And until they allow us to see them, we're not going to trust whatever is it that they say.
Back to you, Mr. Abdullahi. A court, a Nigerian court actually, in Kaduna, has ordered the release of Sheikh Ibrahim Zakzaki, but the government is adamant on continuing to detain him. Is the judiciary really independent in Nigeria?
Well, we cannot say yes. Because if they're independent, the order given must have been complied with. But it seems that they were not independent. Yeah. And we have seen a lot of things where the court has given an order and mm-hmm. it was not being complied by the
government.
Yes, it's ignored by the government. So we cannot say they are defendant, although we are expecting justice from them in the court.
Thank you. Now, the Islamic movement in Nigeria has demanded the freedom of their leader through protests staged across Nigeria, including protests in the capital, Abuja. Defying the ban, the Islamic movement is alive and resolute in its demand for the freedom of Sheikh Zakzaki. The Muslim leader is indeed an emblem of resistance against injustice in the Islamic world today.
I don't think the power of the Islamic movement of Nigeria, and indeed their commitment, could be destroyed by these tactics. If anything, Islamic movement in Nigeria is now more prominent. And indeed, many more people in Nigeria see them as a legitimate opposition against corruption, against this sort of dictatorship, and they actually have become people have become more supportive towards them.
Thank you, Mr. Shajare, for that. Now, Mr. Abdullahi, many members of the Islamic movement in Nigeria are still missing, since the massacre in Zaria in 2015 and throughout the years. Now, what is their fate, actually? Do you know, is there any investigation going on? Are there efforts to, find them?
Well, in fact, we don't have any news, information about them, because we cannot investigate. Though we thought that We are thinking that they were in some detention facilities in some army barracks, but we don't have categorically an information on that.
And is there a way you can follow up through government agencies?
No, there's none. Mm-hmm. There's none, but we hope later.
Thank you for that, and stay tuned for more.
In the fifth anniversary of the crimes, those who lost their loved ones are still far from witnessing justice. Zaria has remained an epicenter for the government attempt to disrupt the movement's religious practices. Even peaceful protests are met harshly and trigger massive crackdown. The loss of lives, meanwhile, has been a source of concern not just for the victims' Muslim brothers across the world, but also human rights organizations. This is while there are reports that the Saudi monarchy has been behind the massive crackdown on the movement. In order to promote Wahhabi doctrine, Riyadh is known to fund Salafist initiatives across the Muslim world and beyond.
There was a WikiLeaks document that showed that the Saudi embassies were putting pressure on Nigeria to tackle the ever-growing popularity of the Islamic movement of Nigeria, but also the officials, including the MBS, the prince, have actually said that we have tackled Iran's influence in Africa and Nigeria. And it's very clear that they are involved, they are financing these massacres.
Now, back to the studio with our guest, Mr. Hussein Abdullahi, a member of the Islamic movement in Nigeria. Now, Mr. Abdullahi, do you think that foreign entities or governments are involved, actually, in the persecution of members of the Islamic movement in Nigeria?
Yes, they were really involved, directly and indirectly.
Okay.
The first evidence of their involvement was that immediately after the carnage, there was some information that we had that from one newspaper, American Times, that the Crown Prince of Saudi Arabia has said that they have reduced the influence of Iran in Nigeria by attacking the Islamic movement. This is one of the example of the involvement of foreign entities. Yes. And also, recently, there were some reports that there were some software that was sold to Nigerian government, whereby they can easily track the pulse of people.
From which company this software is? From which company?
I'm not very sure about
it. Or from which country or state?
Unfortunately, I cannot remember that.
Because there were reports that an Israeli company has sold some spy software to the Nigerian government.
Yes, exactly. It's the same report. It's the same report.
Yeah.
Okay. So another thing also is that there is congratulation made by the same person, that is the Prince of the Saudi
Prince
Arabia.
Salman.
Yes, Prince Salman. He said that he's is congratulating the Nigerian government that they have met some war against terrorism by the time they attack the Islamic movement. So this and the many other examples were evidences that indicate that there were involvement of foreign entities. Another thing, again, is the silence of the main media. For example, the BBC, the British Broadcasting Corporation. In fact, when something less than that happens, they normally broadcast it immediately. Yeah. But this one, they don't
broadcast it. A blackout.
Yes.
Yeah.
So this one. And another thing is that there are a lot of things that happen and they intervene. Yeah. For example, the bell of Sambo Dasuki, that is a security advisor to the Jonathan. They just intervened and he was released.
Yeah.
And this is an indication that their silence is an approval of what has been done to Islamic movement. So these are some of the examples.
Thanks for that. Now, the Islamic movement in Nigeria simply wants the government to do the right thing. The Nigerian government and the military target the Islamic movement while senseless violence and insecurity caused by the likes of Boko Haram remain to be addressed.
a few years after, you could see by 2010, 2011, when the bombings and the attacks started, you know, there was this, I would say, very slow reaction to understanding how deep a threat this was. And then you see by 2013, 2014, the attacks got really, really massive, and it blew on our faces when, you know, there was that Chibok incident when, you know, young girls were, over 200 girls were taken, you know, from school. So if you see why the government started building capacity, acquiring weapons, which they hadn't done for many years, and weapons that actually fit into the theater and the threat that they face, you could see that they started making gains.
Farmers are beheaded, schools are attacked, and bandits raid people's homes. The Islamic movement in Nigeria argues that the reason for the failure to address Takfiri militancy or terrorism is the government's dysfunctional system. The military forces appear to be only capable of suppressing peaceful dissent rather than taking on actual criminals. So are the protests effective?
Well, it's extremely effective. I mean, you give me another place around the world that's 5 years with all these brutality, still people come out, still the standoff. People have, you know, given members of their family, not one or two.
Thank you for that, Mr. Masoud Shajare of the Islamic Human Rights Commission in London. Now, back to you, Mr. Abdullahi. Now, Sheikh Zakzaki has been away, imprisoned for 5 years now. Now, how is the Islamic movement coping with his absence? Is it still continuing with its activities?
Yes, although it is disheartening, the loss of the leader of that kind. However, before he told us that we should continue with what we are doing.
Yeah.
And even before that, he has trained us that not only all things will come from him. We have to have our initiatives.
Yeah.
So all things, all the programs that we accustom, they are progressing. None has stopped.
Oh,
therefore, we cope with that.
So there's no vacuum.
No, there's no vacuum.
Okay, now, as the Islamic movement in Nigeria, are you collaborating with other human rights organizations and civil rights groups in demanding or in pressurizing the Nigerian government to release Sheikh Ibrahim Zakzaki and his wife, and also to probe other incidents of persecution of members of the movement?
Yes, there are a lot. All well-meaning people must be sided with the oppressed.
Yeah.
So we have some civil organizations such as the organization headed by Deji Adeyanju. That is called Nigerian Concern Groups. Nigerian Concern Group is really, we are really working together.
Yeah.
They are involved in our activities of Free Zakzaki campaign.
Yeah.
And most of them were Christians. Most of them are Christian,
that's
but we are together.
Yeah.
We are together. And there were individuals also that were normally, you know, they were against the operation.
Mm-hmm.
So I think there are a lot.
Oh, thank you for that, Mr. Hussein Abdullahi, for joining us today to discuss about the state of the Islamic movement in Nigeria and the continued illegal incarceration of Sheikh Ibrahim Zakzaki. We are looking forward to his release, and that the calls for Free Zakzaki will be listened by the Nigerian government, and he will be released and go back to serve the people and actually the whole society in Nigeria, because I believe he was serving the whole society in Nigeria regardless of religion or sect. Thank you very much for your time.
Yes, thank you so much.
And thank you for watching.
End SARS protests.
Youths in Nigeria are fed up with the way police forces treat innocent people. The social movement against police brutality and extortion initially called for the disbanding of the Special Robbery Squad, SARS. The notorious unit of the Nigerian police has a long record of abuses. But instead of addressing crimes like armed robbery and kidnappings, the forces resorted to human rights violations extrajudicial killings, sexual harassment of women, and brutalizing young people.
A couple of Nigerian youths are in the hospital currently in pains, suffering from results of stray bullets shot directly to unarmed protesters.
The bad record by these Nigerian police unit triggered peaceful protests in 2017 that continue to this day, although the government has resorted to a myriad of tactics to derail the movement. But what are the movement's demands, and are they within reach? We invited author and journalist Eric Welberg to share his view. Mr. Welberg, what's your take?
The primary demand is to release all the protesters that have been jailed, and also they want justice. They want compensation for those that were harmed and injured and killed, some of them during protests. They also want an investigation. They asked, they demanded a panel that would investigate the police actions, police brutality. And interestingly enough, they also asked for an increase in police salaries with the idea to reduce their reliance on bribery and to also make them more accountable for their actions.
SARS has been known for regularly detaining young male Nigerians illegally and extorting money from their relatives. Public outcry returned to social media when video showing a SARS police officer shooting a young Nigerian in front of a hotel went viral in October 2020. The forces have also been accused of widespread torture, mock executions, and other forms of physical and mental abuses. The reform and reorganization of SARS by the government has not only failed to bring an end to the demonstrations, but also infuriated activists across the country, yielding a new phase of the movement.
I think that they have a good possibility of reform, because it's they're strong. They've got 100 years of tradition. The first big demonstrations of Nigerian women were in 1929, and it was against colonial attempts to squeeze market women, of course, dominating the market in Nigeria, and the British colonial government tried to siphon off more money from them.
Protests that swept the country in October against police brutality appear to be coming back. Among the protesters' top demands are the release of all those arrested in the peaceful protests. They are also seeking justice and compensation for all those who lost their lives due to police brutality.
Well, this protest against police brutality, the big place where that's happening is in the United States, but also in Britain, in Europe, in France, there are a lot of protests of police brutality. So I think there is a general groundswell of anger, and these women have really pushed to the forefront in protesting police brutality in Nigeria. So that's a good sign, but they're very angry. They had the same promises in 2017 and 2018, so nothing really seemed to have happened. So I don't know if this time they will succeed.
Now, the movement that started as an effort to reform police now looks like the beginning of a youth awakening in Nigeria. Women are also playing a key role in the movement as diverse communities unite behind one goal to form the backbone of the End SARS protests.
We're here because we believe in what we're fighting for. We are firm to it. And you know, if you listen to our national anthem and our national pledge, we are here to defend our unity.
We are fighting for the truth. We are fighting for the labor of our heroes' past. We don't want it to be in vain.
I prefer to die well for my children to have a better tomorrow. The truth is it.
There have been lots of graphic footage showing police and army officers shooting and abusing protesters. The activists are now wary of bad governance involving vows to investigate killings while simultaneously discrediting reports of abuses. There are meanwhile efforts underway to organize a network of lawyers to provide free legal support to protesters and victims of police abuses across the country. That's the end of today's program. We hope to see Sheikh Zakzaki and his wife out of prison to join their family, friends, and companions. And we wish peace and prosperity for the people of Nigeria. Goodbye for now, and God bless you all.
Our voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran.
Spiritual message of Islam.
His door is open no matter who you are. Just take the first step, you'll see it's not so far. If we all open our eyes to see, he is all that we need right now. And we can all come together somewhere, somehow.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. لا حول ولا قوة إلا بالله العلي العظيم الحمد لله رب العالمين وصلى الله على سيدنا ونبينا أبي القاسم المصطفى محمد وعلى آله الطيبين الطاهرين لا سيما بقية الله في الأرضين أجل الله تعالى فرجه الشريف وجعلنا من أعوانه وأنصاره وشيعته. Last night we continued our discussion about the plan of Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala for having a society for mankind in which justice and then other values which come under justice would be implemented. And we talked about the historical role of the Prophet Ibrahim alayhi salam. We talked about the Prophet Muhammad. We talked about the central role of Mecca in this plan. And the last verse that we discussed was from Surah Baqarah, verse 143. أعوذ بالله من الشيطان الرجيم وكذلك جعلناكم أمة وسطا لتكونوا شهداء على الناس وَيَكُونَ الرَّسُولُ عَلَيْكُمْ شَهِيدًا. As you remember, we said before this sentence and after this sentence, there's a discussion about change of qibla, direction for prayer. And Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala, inside this discussion, makes a very general point. So Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala says, we have made you a middle, a balanced nation. Allah has planned in the way that Rasul is shaheed for us, he's a witness for us, and by following him, and in particular by making sure that we don't go to any extreme, then we become example for other people. This shows how balance is important. Among many other qualities, Allah says this is one of the central and fundamental qualities. I decided to read few hadiths about this important point, and I hope inshallah we all rationally follow this discussion. You know, I am very worried that people, you know, may sometimes misunderstand this important point, but I have responsibility to say this, you know, anyway. Imam Reza alayhi salam, in his famous hadith to Ibn Shabib, you must have heard part of this hadith because frequently mentioned about Imam Hussein alayhi salam. Yabna Shabib, in kunta baqiyan fabki lil Husayn. Fabki lil Husayn ibn Ali, fa innahu dhubha kama yuzbahu al-kabsh. O son of Shabib, if you are going to cry for anything and for anyone, try to cry for Husayn ibn Ali. That is the most important thing for which you can cry. Even if you have sometime, you know, personal problems, or you know, if you lose your dear ones, still it's better to cry for Imam Hussein alayhi salam. Even if you cry for that person, somehow connected to the cry for Imam. Alhamdulillah, we have this habit in community that sympathy is based on strong unity, which cannot be tested when you smile together, when you celebrate together. So the power of crying and sadness and grief is much more than being happy. You know that there are some communities, you know, some sects in Shia Islam, they don't have any sad occasion. You know, the Ismaili community, they only celebrate happy occasions for Ahlul Bayt, only birth anniversaries. Maybe there are exceptions, I don't know, but as far as I know. And I asked one of them, what is the reason for that? Why you don't, you know, commemorate the tragic events? And he explained that, you know, we want to, you know, be happy, and we want to, you know, celebrate their happy occasions. And, you know, he said things that, in my understanding, I don't want to judge and I don't want to blame anyone, but in my understanding was not convincing. I think that is not enough to say, you know, we want to, for example, you know, remember their birth.